So welcome everyone. Thanks for attending the 220 Sunstone Digital Symposiums. This is session 362 titled Psychedelics, Healing, and Spirituality. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of the session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 220. For questions and answers, Steve and Sarah are going to answer those in real time as they come up. They see them on the Whova app, so they're going to ask those. So feel free to ask as the questions come up. That'll probably be the best way to do this. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, there is more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. Here's a little bit about the presentation. The session will discuss the medical, spiritual, and inspirational uses of psychedelic substances, as well as medical uses and safety tips. Let me introduce the speakers. Stephen H. Urquhart teaches health policy at the University of Utah and also practices law. He is a member of the Utah House of Representatives from 2001 to 2008. Majority Whip and Rules Chair, and served in the Utah Senate from 2009 to 2016. Higher Education Sub-Appropriations Chair. Steve is a graduate of Williams College of Biology and BOU Law School, Law Review Honors. He is a director for Equality Utah, Ensign College of Public Health in Ghana, High Rise, Himalayas Public Health, and Voterize. For his efforts to better Utah, Steve has been honored by the ACLU, Equality Utah, the Utah Bar Association, and the Utah Pride Festival. Sarah Urquhart is an organizer of Chaos. She directs events, ensuring professional curated functions that deliver maximum benefit to attendees with minimum hassle. Sarah was the founding director of Altitude Summit, which launched 1,000 blogs and countless successful businesses. Sarah received a BS from BYU in political science and a master's degree from Jacksonville State University in emergency management. Sarah currently sits on the Salt Lake City Planning Commission, the Salt Lake Acting Company Board, and the CIT Utah Board. She chairs the Ambassador Board for the Women's Resource Center at the University of Utah, and has been organizing the Chaos that is Steve's Urquhart for 30 years. She and Steve have 4 adult children, all great.
Thank you so much, Brett.
Thanks.
So well, I'll turn the time over to you guys.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Well, thanks everybody for being here. This is a topic that Steve and I are both excited to talk about, and something that we know a lot of people are curious about, or are maybe you've jumped in with 2 feet and you want to just be a part of this conversation and connect with other people in the community. Either way, we're really happy to have you here, and I'm just going to jump in.
Yeah, please.
Okay. So, plant medicine calls to you when you're ready for it. Now, that's going to be the most hippie thing you hear me say this whole time, but I'm going to say it again. Plant medicine calls to you when you're ready for it. So I want to give some history about me. I was a Mormon that was all in. I never tasted alcohol, never experimented with drugs. I really didn't ever have an interest in it. I even would limit my intake of aspirin. You know, it might be a gateway drug for me. I just was super conscious what I was putting in my body on that front. And the other thing you should know, I find myself on the autism spectrum, so I have a difficulty breaking rules. I'm a real rule follower. And that being said, I really liked all the rules that the church offered me, and I followed all of them as best I could. Even when I knew they were hurting me, figuring there must be a reason. But as I transitioned away from the church, plant medicine made its way onto my radar. And From the very start, I was cautious but curious. And I had my first experience with plant medicine doing ayahuasca in Holland, because remember, I'm a rule follower, so I wasn't willing to do it here in the States. I had to go where it was legal. But preceding that, I want to tell this story, and I have to go in order. About 2 weeks before our trip, I happened to have a therapy session planned. It was on the books. I went in, and I walked in kind of on fire. I had had some major heartbreaks in my life in the two or three preceding years, and I was tired of thinking about them. I had issues with Steve. I had issues with my family of origin. I had some issues with my career. And I felt like I'd been in therapy for a number of years, and we weren't making progress at the speed that I wanted to make progress. So, and as a background, you should know my therapist at the time was a bishopric, in a bishopric. I really loved and trusted him, and he's still a believing member of the church. I really think he's great, but that comes in a minute. So I walked into this therapy session with my list of 5 things. And I said, we're going to settle these things today. We're going to address them head on. We're just going to take them on, and we're going to fix them. And I said, I'm tired of talking about it. I'm tired of thinking about it. Let's just deal with it and move past. And of course, my patient therapist said, that's not how therapy works. We had a horrible session, and I left very frustrated. So remember, 2 weeks later, we are in an ayahuasca session. We had done some research, and we found somebody that we felt very safe with. I wanted a small group, meaning just me and Steve. So we found ourselves in the home of our guide, or trip sitter, and we'll talk about that a little later. I was very nervous about the experience, and I was worried that I would feel out of control and vulnerable in all the worst ways. So I really, this experience, you know, I was anxious about it. We started the session, and Steve, he wanted all the frills. He wanted candles and music and drums and eagle feathers and anything else she had to offer. I wanted no frills. I wanted clinical. I wanted, if she had a lab coat, that probably would have made me feel better. I wanted very simple and very predictable. So during the session, Steve was across the room, and he was having an extremely mystical experience. It really was changing his life, his mind. And I had my foot fully on the brakes, and I was just resisting everything about the experience and getting frustrated because I wasn't having the experience. But, you know, after the fact, I could see, oh, it was a lot me. I was putting the brakes on. So as Steve came out of his experience hours later, he was happy and changed and overwhelmed, and I was grumpy. We had done all of this for nothing, all the travel, all the money, and I got nothing out of it. I was feeling the same kind of frustration that I had had when I left the therapist's office just a couple of weeks before. And my guide kindly said, as she was finishing up the night, she said, the medicine is still in your body and it will be for a couple of days. So let it do its work and be patient. And I rolled my eyes, okay, whatever. That felt too mystical for me. But I fell asleep for a couple of hours. And as I was waking up, I was in that place between sleep and awake. And I had a full conversation with myself. And I'm going to stop here to say I completely understand why people believe in God when they have these experiences. Because this conversation I'm telling you about could absolutely be considered a conversation with God. But I believe it's my brain tapping into other parts of my brain that I don't normally have access to. So The conversation went back and forth. It was very clearly one side, then the other side, and I'm responding. So I pulled up those questions in my brain that I'd prepared for my therapist, and I went through my series of questions. I asked about Steve and what I should do, and I got a very clear answer, which I'll talk about in a moment. I asked about a heartbreak in my career and how to let that go. I got a very clear answer. I asked about the losses I was feeling with my siblings, and I got an answer. I went one by one through that list, and I received an answer to every question. And remember, these are questions I've been struggling with for years, and there they were, all of them answered. I fully woke up, and I said to Steve, okay, we can go home. I'm done. And it was, you know, that was all I needed from this, but I was able to get that really great experience. So, and that was, like I said, that was my first experience. I've had other experiences since where I've learned other insights, but I do want to go through a few specific things I want to tee up so that it, because I'm going to be referencing some of this throughout the rest of the conversation. First of all, if you're doing this, I want you to remember you may not get the answer you want, but it's likely the answer you need. My answer about Steve, as I was contemplating Steve and was in some of my frustrations with him, I had a very clear realization that Steve was giving me everything that he could. He was putting it all on the table for me. And the other part of the realization was it wasn't enough for me. And that was the answer. He's giving everything. It's not enough. So, and we will continue to talk about that. I returned to my therapist. When I got back from my trip, I had all these answers because I'd taken notes. And he used that, my good Mormon therapist, he actually took all the insights, took it very seriously, and used those things as a template for my therapy for the next year. And it touched on all the things I needed, but then he was able to help me go very deep and really internalize each of these insights. It was tremendous. And that's a big part of this, is your work comes after the session. The session can be fun or not, you know, it can be what it is, but the work comes after. I do believe I would have gotten the insights, all of these same insights eventually, but I think this moved me ahead about 5 years, that all of those answers were somewhere in my brain. It just would have taken a lot of work to find them. And so that's one of the things I love about this, is it really moves some things forward for me. And then the other element of that is I think of plant medicine as training wheels, that you can access these other parts of your brain. We're just not used to it. Some people get there with yoga. Some people get there with meditation. And eventually, using plant medicine, you can get there on your own. But your body and your brain need to understand how to do it. And the plant medicine helps you with that. So, you know, you could take plant medicine forever, but it also, you can use it until you're ready to do this kind of work on your own. So, okay, all of that said, I am going to have Steve talk about one of his experiences.
Okay, thank you. So Sarah and I, that last question is good. Okay. Sarah and I are very different people. And as you can tell, her approach, she likes what I call the John Hopkins modality. I'm going to talk about a lot of research that they do, and they have the eye shades and, you know, music, and you're on a couch with someone watching you. And so very medical therapeutic kind of approach. And so when I talk, if you want to burn some sage and pound some drums, that might be appropriate. I take more of a mystical approach to all of this, but that's the fun thing about it. It shouldn't be dogmatic. That's something you're going to hear us talk about. You should be in control of this. No one should shame you and tell you that they're up here because they've done it and you're down here. These are experiences that you should be able to kind of pick and choose how you want to do them. And we will talk a great deal about safety. First, I want to acknowledge this moment we're in, the pandemic. This is difficult on a lot of us. And I just want to put out the thought that reach out to your people and let them know that you're there for them, and also let them know that you need them. So that's my PSA before I really get going on this. Okay, many religions start with the founder and a few early acolytes having a mystical type experience. And so by that, I mean a non-normal experience. And this can be a pillar of light. It can be a vision, a burning bush, a dream, something that is not normal. And at times I will call this space a mystical state of consciousness. And here's where you start to see the departure points between me and Sarah. I will also call this the sanctum sanctorum, the holy of holies, or the baptism of fire. I also will often call psychedelics entheogens, and entheogens simply means something that empowers us to access the divine within. In the founding years of Mormonism, like other religions, Joseph Smith was not the only member to commune with God. Other early acolytes also communed with God in mystical states of consciousness. All but two of the sections of the Doctrine and Covenants and the two directives came within the first year of the church's birth. And then after that, other than administrative directives, I would suggest that the heavens closed to Mormonism. Currently, were anyone to personally commune with the divine and have a major revelation about God, being with God, the nature of God, that person, I would guess, would be excommunicated if he or she did not largely keep quiet about it. I will tell you later, my next go around on this, about a local leader who did see the face of God.
Mormon
leader. Thank you. And how that affects his ministry. But otherwise, and of course, he isn't public about it other than sharing it with me and a couple of other close friends. You know, for the most part, revelation inside the religion needs to fit into precast molds. Now, William James and other religious philosophers, they note that communion with the divine in these mystical states of consciousness, it has a noetic quality about it. And what that means is that it is absolutely authoritative to the person receiving it. But it doesn't need to be authoritative to anyone else. And so while Sarah, she would say that there is nothing religious about her experiences, I would think, and probably not much spiritual, when I hear her describe them, I do hear a noetic quality that does suggest to me some religiosity, that to her it is authoritative, and we access it somewhat in different ways. She accesses it in the subconscious, where I would suggest she believes the divine exists. And while I do believe I access a lot of it within, I access a lot of it outside too, that I do believe are personal revelations. Okay, so with all of this in mind, I simply want to share with you to tell you what this means to me, an experience that I did have with the divine in the Sanctum Sanctorum, the Holy of Holies. It is absolutely authoritative to me and wonderfully transformative in my life. And at the end, I'm going to ask you to forget how I got there. Forget that I'm talking about psychedelics and just ask yourself, is it not a miracle? Is it not something valuable and wonderful in my life? Okay, so the experience I'm going to tell you about, it was in a session with ayahuasca and psilocybin. I doubled up a bit. And at this point in my life, I've always had anxiety, and it was just crippling me. The only thing that I could do was be a state senator. For whatever reason, I was still highly functional in that capacity, but other aspects of my life, I was barely functional.
It was a mess.
Yeah, it was a complete mess. I was alone. I was scared. I didn't even open mail for 8 months, which is not a good thing for a lawyer and a state senator. But like a lot of problems in the heart, in the head, there was no X, there was no dotted line that said cut here, fill there. So I went to several different therapists, was taking several different psychotropic drugs, and none of that really scratched the surface. So I was hurt, and I was hurting other people around me. So in this ceremony, which happened to have some of the best musicians I know, which that really added to things, I found myself on the corner of Ridgeview and Ridgecrest in Houston, Texas. And that's when I was 10 years old in fifth grade. I was a crossing guard, and I had the official sash and silver badge, a cane pole with a flag on the end that said stop. And I was brought back to that place. And, you know, I think this is often part of therapy, to go back and see how things really were. And it just hit me in full force how afraid and alone I was. Now, let me briefly talk about psychological trauma. I'm going to jump ahead to what Sarah's going to say. If I had stayed in that place, that would have been bad. That can happen if you don't have good guides, if you don't have the right set and setting. Or maybe you just kind of get stuck there for whatever reason, you get interrupted. And you want to get out of that place. And so that's why Sarah will talk about integration. And so I was brought to that place, and I just remembered that I would stand there. I picked that corner because there wasn't a lot of action, and I would just cry. I'd just sit there and stand there and cry. I'd watch for students coming, and I would wipe my tears and stop crying, get them across the street. Then I'd just start crying again because I was so alone. My brother had killed himself. No adult talked with me about it. My parents hated each other. I just had no idea what was going on in life. And I was just so sad, so afraid, so alone. And, you know, I just didn't really know that. I mean, I'm 55 years old now. I didn't know that I carried that so intact in my soul. And so, you know, I was just sobbing in this ceremony. So this tremendous guide, he came over and he's like, what's going on? And so I told him, and, you know, he listened. He asked good questions to draw it out. And he said, it's time for you to let that go. It no longer serves you. What? So I sat up. I said, what do you mean? What do you mean? How am I supposed to just let this go? I don't even really know what it is. I can't describe it. Why did this happen? All, you know, all the normal kinds of questions you ask. And so he said, I don't know. He said, ask the medicine. And so by this point, I'd been doing the medicine quite a bit, and I did have faith in it. And so I figured, okay, yeah, this is where the magic happens. It's not talking. It's not dancing, although I do tons of that during a ceremony. And it's not really thinking. It's just sitting back and letting the medicine pour over you, open you up. And so, again, I saw how alone I was. And there was just this big gooey puddle of Steve all over the floor. But then I just had this thought. It just was. I mean, that was the comprehensive psychological, sociological. I mean, every explanation for it, it just was. Which you can imagine in a normal state of consciousness, a non-mystical state of consciousness, if you were told, hey, buddy, this just was, move forward, that wouldn't do the trick, right? I mean, that might make you really mad. But in that suggestive state of consciousness, that was the entire answer. That's exactly what I needed. And so healing, which that did heal me, that realization that I was in this scary place all by myself, but that I no longer was, I was able to progress and move forward. And so when I first started going into this trip, you know, I love it. It's carnival, it's circus, all sorts of silly, wonderful, spectacular things. And for me, that's always just getting my attention. I'm way ADHD. That's part of anxiety, part of all the problems. And it really locks me in and focuses me. And then when it focuses me, it just gives me the simplest revelations. The first big one I ever had was, it had just been this magic, mystical experience. And the revelation I got was, do more dishes. You're not doing enough around the home to show Sarah you love her. Do the dishes. Then the next one I had was, you need to play more games with your daughter. That's her love language. And so it's so funny that now I just expect to get these very pragmatic, mundane, day-to-day revelations. But in this one that I'm telling you about, early on I had seen this huge warrior standing guard over someone. And he was just magnificent. And so I went up and checked him out. I mean, I'm just right up in his face checking him out. And he bows to me. And I didn't know what that was all about. But then later, when I had this vision of me on the corner, that I was so alone, so scared, I went to the bathroom and looked in the mirror, and who was looking back at me? It was that warrior. And I just realized that I was looking at my soul. So at 10 years old, 80 pounds, standing on that corner, so alone, so afraid, that was my soul that had protected me. And for the first time in my life, I just loved myself hard. I really honored myself and thanked all the earlier versions of me that carried me forward to this point where I could heal. And then got back on my mat where the magic happens. And so I saw the people in my life and I saw that I only loved them partially. That hurt so much. The people around me, especially, some of my kids, they need me to comfort them. They need me to show them the world. And I hadn't done that because I had only shown up partially to everyone around me. Now, remember, I was locked in a place where I'm standing guard as a fifth grader. Try to have a conversation with the guard at Buckingham Palace. You can't do it. They notice everything, but they don't see anything. Because if they're truly seeing something, something could be sneaking up from some side. And so, again, I'm broken. There's a puddle of me, and I'm just sobbing. And boom, I feel a head on my chest, and one of the attendees, her head's just on my chest, her hair over my face. She's just, stroking my cheek. And others came, they sang to me, and they're just comforting me so I don't get too lost in this, because it was so sad to realize I only love partially. Now, what did Sarah just tell you? That a few years before in an ayahuasca ceremony, she realized Steve is giving me everything he can, but it's not enough. And when I heard that, with the abusive self-talk I've always had, I just figured, yeah, she's on to me. I'm not enough. And it was sad. I was despondent. And it never occurred to me that I could be more, that I could love more. But that is what I got out of this ceremony. I saw just these simple acts, these simple things where I could love more, where I could love fiercely, which, all the words we use for this, being present, being authentic. And I had told Sarah many times before, I said, I know tons of people. I can walk into a party and make friends with everyone, but I don't think I really know anyone. I don't think anyone really knows me, cares that much about me, because I was always standing guard, right? If I'm saying it's always, I'm fine, it's okay, then that's just telling everyone around me I don't really want to connect, because obviously I wasn't fine, it wasn't all okay, but I had the clear conviction that it could be okay, that I could work toward this. And since then, all of my relations are, I love fiercely, they're whole. I'm able to tell the people in my life how much I love them, how much I need them, how much they mean to me, and I'm a much more whole and sound person. So again, forget how I got there. Forget that it's psychedelics and that's what I'm talking about. For that to occur in someone's life, that is an absolute miracle. And so I want to reiterate, while I say I was healed, a miracle happened, having built muscles carrying psychological baggage, I don't want to imply for a second that this takes the place of licensed professional therapists, FDA approved drugs. At times we need those. And so I think that psychedelics can open doors to where we can walk through. And often we walk through those doors with trained professionals. So thank you for listening to that. And I'll turn it back to Sarah to talk about safety.
Okay. And we do have some good questions coming in. So we want to, we're passing this back and forth. We want to roll those into part of what we're talking about. And if you have additional questions, you know, make sure you're putting them in, and we are going to get to all of them. If we don't get to them during the presentation, we'll make sure we go back after and address any that we don't cover during this hour. Okay, so Steve and I both gave you experiences that we've had, but something that my very practical brain wants to do is always talk about setting and safety. If, as I was doing my research and somebody asked about that, I think it was Holly asked, how we did the research. Steve will get into that a little bit, more, some of what we did, some of the books we read, but I was doing Google searches. And, you know, as I was talking to people, I was really looking for the bad experiences. I wanted to know the worst case scenarios. And they were so, I had a hard time finding them. They, you know, I was just wading through all mostly good experiences, but some of the bad experiences had to do with the vulnerable state you're in, and not having somebody who really can help you get through that. And so those are some of the things I'm going to talk about is, if you're going to participate in this, how do you stay safe? And I'm specifically talking about, you know, everybody, but I want to address women specifically through this. Okay, how and where you have your experience will mean a lot. For me, my first experience, I told you, we were in somebody's home. It was just me and Steve. Sometimes a crowd is a little much for me. I mean, I'm okay in crowds, but in that vulnerable state, that didn't feel comfortable to me. So I needed a place where I had, that I felt safe. And so just me and Steve, that's part of what that looked like to me. Part of this is, don't ever feel forced. Your first time, your 10th time, don't ever feel the peer pressure to participate. You know, so, well, this shaman's only going to be in town, you know, only comes to town twice a year. There are other people. Don't feel, if you are not up for that session, even if you sign up and then decide it's not, that you are not mentally prepared, do not participate. Don't ever feel that heavy pressure. Don't ever feel forced. But it is okay to feel nervous. You're entering into an altered state, and you can feel nervous even multiple times into it. I had to get to a point where I was asking Steve, as my guide, to remind me that I want to learn I want to get comfortable in that state. So even though it feels uncomfortable to me because it's not predictable, he could gently remind me that I signed up for this and that I want to get more comfortable in that state. So, you know, but I had to tell him in advance, that's what I needed. So it's okay to feel nervous. Only partake when it's calling to you. And I said that earlier, when, you know, that's ongoing. I might say, you know what, this Friday, I'm up for some work. I might do something this Friday. But if I haven't been sleeping well, or I've had some extra stressors, and I'm not mentally in a good place, I'll put it off. I'm just not going to go into it if I'm not comfortable. this is a big one for me. And it's a red flag if it's not happening. Know what you're ingesting and know how much. Know your dosage. I have friends who have told me about their experiences, and I'm saying, okay, what were you on? What did that to you? Well, it's a surprise mix that my shaman won't tell me what it is. And, I won't put anything in my body if I don't know what it is, how much is in the dosage. Because I can kind of track whether I'm writing it down or I know in my brain, I don't react well to this, or this is what my body does, or I want to try lower dosage or more dosage. So if somebody's keeping something a secret from you, I would use that as a red flag, see that as a red flag, and I would not participate. The other element of that is there are shamans who say, you know, the madre tells me how much I'm going to give you, and every person gets a different amount. I do not believe that person's getting any kind of insight about me. I want to know what we're taking, want to know how much, and it shouldn't change. I also believe that shaman is slipping things in for, you know, some people that he's not giving to others. I feel that's super inappropriate. And, you know, you can demand to know on those things, and you should know. It's a very suggestive time. And so, you know, another shaman we know, he'll go around the room, because people, you go into this with intentions usually. This is what I want to learn, or this is what I need to work on. And he'll point somebody out and go, the madre has big plans for you. You know, that's going to be a bad night for you. Of course it's a bad night, because it's such a suggestive time. Don't let anybody stick that kind of thing in your brain. Look for guides and sitters who will deliver what you want. We've talked about it. Steve wants bells and whistles. I want pretty clinical. And so, you know, find people who will give you that, because they're out there. And we'll talk a little bit more about how we connect with each other. I would suggest taking notes. And most importantly, do that follow-up work we've been talking about. And then this note for women. It is okay to seek experiences led by and that are full of women. Sometimes it's harder for women to get into the space, or harder for women to feel safe in the space. But if we demand more of that, it will happen more. So I would suggest doing that. And then as far as recovery, just know you're going to be dehydrated, know you're going to be exhausted, and you should give yourself time after the fact to recover mentally, spiritually, socially, emotionally, all of those things. You know, don't try to dive right straight into work afterwards. Just be kind to yourself. So that's a lot of things we talked about: setting and safety. I hope we covered. If you have additional questions, let us know.
Okay, and just following on that, I want to point out that the toxicity and the addictive potential of a lot of these substances is very minimal. And so, you know, I don't ever mess with drugs that mess with my heart and my breathing. That's just a bad idea. So that would be a lot of the opioids. You know, these medicines, physically, they're going to take care of you. But let me take off on what Sarah just said. Afterwards, you can be tired and dehydrated. So, you know, I have a friend who, in a session, he ended up going to the ER the next day because we had done, in a week, we'd done 4 all-night ceremonies. And he then, after the last one, didn't sleep, got on the road, and you're eating poorly on the road. And his electrolytes got low. And, you know, that can throw you off. And so that's just simply something of being tired and being dehydrated. So, you know, and then also, of course, when you're on these substances, you want to make sure that you stay inside the container, inside the space. You don't want to wander off, because you're in an altered state of consciousness, right? And you can get into a lot of trouble. So this is why you want people around you. You want a lot of wind up going into this. Here's what you might expect. Here's a safe word we're going to say. Because it's not like you're completely out of your mind. you do have the ability to communicate and to understand things. And especially if you have a touchstone, something to bring you back that you talked about in advance, then you can be rational during most of these experiences. Did you have something else?
No. Well, yeah, but I'll get to it during the questions.
Okay. So that is all I would really add to safety. And do it, you know, if you're going to go in for surgery, you're going to research the heck out of your doctors. If you're going to have your first experience or two, do the same. You know, if someone says, hey, I know some guy, and then you're just there, well, that's not great research. And so remember, as Mormons, we are part of the most connected community in the world. And there are a lot of folks still in the church or who no longer attend who are into entheogens. And so you can start the right conversations. One thing that I'm spending time on is the Divine Assembly, the divineassembly.org. And that is a way where people are connecting in this space. Because a lot of you, I see questions, I want to do this. How do I get it? Let's talk about legalities. These things, these substances, they really kind of were discovered in the 40s, 50s. Albert Hofmann, he had synthesized LSD before. They didn't find great uses for it. He went back to it, and on April 19th, 1943, he took just the mother load of LSD. That's how they used to test a lot of this, was they just try it on themselves. And he thought for sure he was going to die. And so he got on his bicycle and rode home. That must have been quite a journey. And so 419 is called Bicycle Day. So then a few years later, this fellow, Gordon Wasson, who was an investor, so he had a lot of financial resources, he and his wife had been searching for magic mushrooms. They heard that they were out there, and they found their way to Maria Sabina in Mexico, Mazteca. And that was like 1955. And then it was profiled in Life magazine in 1957. And these things really became the rage for psychotherapists because they work. They absolutely work. I'm going to get to some of the science later. But then they became associated with the counterculture. Timothy Leary, Richard Nixon declared Timothy Leary the most dangerous man on the planet. And, you know, Timothy Leary, there was a lot of exuberance there and a lot of excess. And, you know, if you poke against culture too much, culture's going to win. And so under the Controlled Substance Act, almost all of these things we're talking about were banned in 1970. And then they started to make a resurgence through this group that they remembered the science. And there was a lot of it, a lot of journals just saying how great these things are. I'll give you one touch point. The founder of AA, Bill Wilson, you might know that part of AA is you're supposed to surrender to a higher power. Bill Wilson became acquainted with his higher power in 1934 through belladonna, a hallucinogenic plant alkaloid. And so that is always what he meant by the higher power. And then in the 50s, when he saw how well LSD was working with addiction, he wanted that to be part of AA. So these things were pretty widely accepted. Then they went away. Then in 2007, researchers at Johns Hopkins, they did a study whether psilocybin, so that's the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, whether that could occasion mystical experiences in users. And 2/3 of the people they tested, and this was double blind with placebo, 2/3 said it was one of the top 5 spiritual experiences of their life. And 1/3 said it was the most spiritual experience of their life. And so that was the start of medicalization, largely led by Johns Hopkins University. You can see some good stuff there. And then also the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS. Johns Hopkins is mostly doing things with psilocybin on treatment-resistant depression. They have phase 2 fast-track FDA studies going on. So likely psilocybin will be rescheduled in a couple years, as it does have, how do I not use the word miraculous, as it has tremendous capabilities to treat depression, because it helps us deprogram. As Sarah said, it helps our thinking ruts reprocess, and we can see things differently, just as I told you about seeing my childhood and then letting it go. Then MAPS, they're focused primarily on MDMA, which some of you might know. You've heard about it as Molly or ecstasy. So a party drug, right? A dance drug. They have been using that to treat PTSD, and they're even further along. They're in phase 3 studies showing tremendous results. And so that likely will be rescheduled in a year. So the medicalization is happening wonderfully. But it can't, these substances can't just be to heal sick people. They also can be used for the betterment of well people. And that happens through spirituality. That happens through religion. And so I'll just take 1 minute on that. The First Amendment, it protects religious beliefs and religious practices. And then Religious Freedom Restoration Act, it goes a step further and says that government can't interfere with religion, sincerely held belief, unless it just meets the highest thresholds of scrutiny, which it can't meet if it's looking at sincerely held religious belief. So there've been a couple of successful court cases involving ayahuasca, where even the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that ayahuasca is the sacrament of this religion, and the federal government cannot interfere with this Brazilian-based sect, UDF, Union of the Plants, União do Vegetal. It can't interfere with their sacrament. And so part of what the Divine Assembly is it has psilocybin as a sacrament, believing that it can commune, people can use it to commune directly with the divine. So it isn't hierarchical, top-down dogma, because it is mutually supportive, interconnected, so that everyone has the opportunity to commune directly. And through that communion, just like I have done, just like Sarah has done, receive direct guidance on how each person can better live his or her life. And so with that, maybe let's dive into some of the questions, again, at all turns.
I want you to talk about your friend.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Let me talk about within the Mormon context, because Sarah and I no longer go. I still consider myself Mormon. These are my people. I say that I'm so Mormon, I'm going to be reincarnated as a Mormon down in Provo. But we're largely outside the religion at this point. However, I recently met up with a friend from childhood, so we know each other extremely well, not worth hiding any secrets. So he asked how I was doing spiritually, and I appreciated the question. And I told him the experience I shared with you about being in the Sanctum Sanctorum. I shared that. I shared other experiences. And told him how much, again, because I'm fully human now, or more human than I can connect, I told him how much I love him and appreciate him, and that he has always cared about me. And we're both just sobbing, and it was beautiful. And he's hesitantly told me he had something to share with me. So he's a local leader where he lives. And he talked about when he saw the face of God. And it wasn't through prayer. It wasn't through reading scriptures. It wasn't in the temple. It's when he was doing an ayahuasca session. He actually had done several. I found out to my blissful surprise. And he said that in one of those, he actually saw the face of God and knew that God is love. Now that's not profound, right? Because we hear that, we even say that all the time. But in these mystical states of consciousness, remember the noetic quality where it's absolutely authoritative, he just really felt that in every cell of his body, that God is love, full stop. And so what he says is that when he hears in general conference fear-based or shame-based teachings, his mind, because he has seen the face of God through psychedelics, it automatically translates that language to where there aren't any contingencies, there aren't any only ifs, yeah, but, that it is just pure love. And that is what he shares with his congregation. And he just says that it's so good for his soul. It is so good for the souls of, you know, imagine these young people who come in and they're just horrible because they've committed this grievous sin. And his response is, God loves you. You're trying your best. You know, let's go forward from here. So, you know, this all isn't only for, you know, folks outside the church, although there is a lot of, at that point, a lot of healing, a lot of deprogramming that needs to happen. But it's also for folks in the church who do believe in direct revelation, that they can have an experience where they might, if they're lucky, commune with God and see the face of God.
Okay. So we're going to do some questions now. But one thing as we tee those up, I skipped over one element of setting and safety that I really do want to make sure we cover. As you find a place to have a session and you're looking into that, I avoid all the dogma. If somebody, my guide, is telling me all the ways I have to fast, you know, abstain from sex, what I can and cannot eat, it, you know, too many rules, big red flag for me. Again, your job, my guide's job is to provide a safe place, let me know what I'm ingesting, you know, and keep me safe during the experience. It's not to dictate all these other things in my life. So just keep that in mind as you are preparing and you're having these sessions. And the more we ask that of these guides, the more they'll provide that. So that's, you know, I want this to be a part of the community here in the area. Okay, so Holly is saying, how do I get started? Where do I start? That's a big question. Are you asking to take it back?
No, I can take it.
Okay.
Did you want to
handle this? That's fine. No, go ahead.
Okay, so a couple of resources that I meant to mention. Michael Pollan, he wrote a book, How to Change Your Mind. That is a great place to start on all of this. Also a film, Fantastic Fungi, is wonderful. I just recently came across a podcast, Mormons on Mushrooms. Talked with the two hosts. I love the vibe they're sending out. Shakruna Institute has great materials, C-H-A-C-R-U-N-A. I learned a lot from Psychedelics Today. Those are some good places to start. And then in terms of where do you personally access this, you access it through conversations, through communications. You know, obviously Sarah and I were saying, here we are, we do this stuff. And so, you know, you might want to start talking with us, and you'll just quickly find how many people in your network, they use these substances to improve themselves. And, you know, it's going to be in private conversations. So if you're asking on Facebook, where do I find this? Well, no one really wants to go to jail. And so, you know, you're not going to get an answer that way, but you will get answers through private individual conversations. Do you have more on that?
No. I'm going to jump to another question. Okay. And then scroll up so we can see them all. So somebody mentioned her mother having migraines, headaches, and wondering if cannabis would have been a better option than opioids. I'm sorry. It sounds like your mother's passed. I'm sorry about that. My thought is always anything where you can move away from big pharma, especially opioids, you know, I would have tried everything. I, you know, same thing. We have these really great, I have a couple I know really well, and, you know, he's had every position in the church and, on local levels, and he is dying of cancer, and one of his daughters showed up with some edibles, which has been super helpful for him. I am shocked that they would have been open to it. But when you're in pain, when you need real healing, I think you need to try all of the things. Some of them work, some of them don't, but figure out the things that your body is going to respond to. So that's how I would answer that.
Yeah, and then also talking about the medicalization of these substances, regarding opioids, which is a huge epidemic in Utah, it is nationwide. There's a psychedelic substance out of West Africa, and now it grows, well, let me stick with that, iboga, and it can absolutely cure opioid addiction. Not in every case, but in many cases, and in almost all cases, it's a good start. It just loves hard on those opioid receptors, and so people have the mystical experience, which, again, the founder of AA, that is his philosophy, is people need to see the vision of heavens. They need to see a higher power to know that there's more than this. So iboga and iboga-related substances, they can occasion that experience and just tell your opioid receptors it's all okay. And that gives people a huge start on the withdrawals that they otherwise would experience. So it's so exciting that medical science is starting to once again open up to plants that are readily available that are so good for us.
Okay, we have 5 minutes left. So I want you to pick out the best questions.
Okay, I'm going to talk about ketamine. So something you can fully do legally. Ketamine, what these things do is they open you up, a dissociative. And so they allow, again, what Sarah talked about, what can be dangerous, it also is the beneficial part where it is suggestive. You're open to suggestion. Well, tell me about your childhood. How did that feel? What are your relationships with people? So ketamine, there are a bunch of providers here in Utah. My friend, Dr. Scott Allen, does it in St. George where we lived. I know there are several up here in Salt Lake. And these things legally can open the door and get you started down that healing pathway.
So, and I would say, so just make sure we are covering everything. We will go, like I said, we will go back through all those questions. If, as you're getting into the space, there are a couple of things, you know, if you see a currently see a therapist, see what they suggest, see if they will work that, this integration into your experiences or your therapy so that when you have the experience, they, you know, you have some help doing the work after. Make sure you do that. You know, finding a shaman, finding a guide, talk to friends. This is where, going back to our Mormon roots, this is where people have give testimonials. This is where, you know, what really testimony meaning should be is a lot of this was a good experience or this was not, so that we're really talking to each other.
Okay, and I have a couple things at the bottom here. I have my catch-all in case we haven't touched on any of these things. I want to talk about decriminalization efforts. A lot of these plants have been decriminalized, which doesn't mean they're legal. It just means that law enforcement, local law enforcement, won't go after them. Decriminalized in Oakland, Denver, and Santa Cruz. There are efforts going on in Utah to decriminalize psilocybin and maybe more plants in some cities. Also, integration, I want to reemphasize that after the experience, that's when a lot of the work starts. What did I experience? Why did I experience that? And for many of us, that should involve licensed professionals. And other folks are learning to, some of them already licensed social workers or therapists, others not. They're going through specialized psychedelic integration training and that's just wonderful. Microdosing is something we should touch on. That means that you just take a small amount of these, maybe 2 times a week. And so you get a lot of the positive impacts, though you don't, you know, have a full psychotropic experience. And so this is something cultures have used forever, like before hunting, they would take small amounts of these because their eyesight, their senses are all peaked. And so they have believed, and rightly so, that they can sense things around them more readily.
Okay, so as we finish, if this is calling to you, find somebody to talk to. Find somebody who has had a good experience and start down that path. If you'd like to reach out to us, we'd love to talk to you about that and help you get started. But my guess is you're going to have people super connected to you. Log on to thedivineassembly.org, be a part of that conversation. And I wish you great luck. I think this is such a good thing for our hearts, our minds, our bodies. And whether you decide you need all of the bells and whistles like Steve, or you want something a little more practical like me, there's not a wrong way to do this. As long as you're thinking about setting and safety, there's nothing but healing in front of you, and I wish you the best of luck.
We can conclude with that. I'm Steve Urquhart at Facebook. Probably not too tough to get me. As you can tell, I think these things are life-changing. Happy to help you with any steps forward.
All right. Thanks, Namaste. Everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.